Community Alliance of Tenants is working to increase awareness in Washington County of the statewide law SB 608 that was passed in early 2019. It limits rent increases and no-cause terminations for residential leases. There is a temporary bilingual English and Spanish hotline set up for Washington County renters with questions about SB 608, rent increases, no-cause termination notices, and/or lease non-renewal notices. Phone number is 503-644-3007. Again, that's the Renter's Right hotline phone number for Washington County every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. through January 30th at 503-644-3007. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm right in the middle of solving that riddle known as raising the rent.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up, we have Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon, an interview with a series designed to bring Washington County residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community.
I think that there is, in general, disgust about big money in politics that goes across the political spectrum. I think no matter whether you're a working class Republican or a working class Democrat, you feel that the system is somewhat rigged, and you feel that the average Joe doesn't have a voice in the system.
Welcome to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. We feature interviews with leaders in the community focusing on issues important to Washington County.
Welcome to Inside Washington County. I'm Rob Solomon. Our guest today is Jason Kafuri. Jason is a Portland-based attorney and leading champion for campaign finance reform in Oregon. He chaired the campaign for Honest Elections in 2016, which supported Multnomah County ballot measure 26184. Measure 26184 amended the Multnomah County Charter to set campaign contribution and expenditure limitations and establish disclosure laws. The measure passed with 89% of the Multnomah County vote, but was struck down by Multnomah County Judge Block. Mr. Kafuri has continued his advocacy on this issue. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you so much for having me.
Very much our pleasure. Jason, Oregon, unlike most other states, has virtually no limits to contributions to state or local campaigns. In what way does that cause problems?
Yeah, like you said there, we are the Wild West. We are one of five states with no limits at all on political contributions. What that leads to is a huge influence in big money. A couple telling statistics. Oregon has the second highest per capita spending on our legislative races in the country, second only to New Jersey. Because we have no limits on what an individual or a corporation can give, in this last gubernatorial race, Newt Bueller received $3.5 million in direct donations from one individual, Phil Knight. We have a system where spending is out of control on campaigns, big money influences, and you know, a lot of states, almost half the states, ban corporations from giving money at all. But here, corporations, individuals, can give unlimited money. This all started from an Oregon Supreme Court decision in 1997, where the Oregon Supreme Court, based on the state constitutional free speech clause, found that limiting money in politics was a violation of people's constitutional free speech rights. We are fighting that, as you pointed out. We're this Thursday, November 14th, arguing at 1:30 down at the Oregon Supreme Court about the constitutionality of limits and money in politics. And we've built a huge coalition. We have Multnomah County, the attorneys backing us up. We have several national experts that have written amicus briefs. And we even have the ACLU, who initially opposed our efforts for decades, saying it was a violation of free speech, and they've now changed their tune and filed an amicus brief in support of limiting donations to political candidates. So we feel great about the momentum, and we're very hopeful that the Oregon Supreme Court will follow the other 36 states that basically have the exact same free speech language in their state constitutions and allow limits on money in politics.
Out of those 36 states, pass legislation that goes against the well-known Supreme Court Citizens United decision?
The Citizens United decision did not impact limits to direct candidate contributions. Citizens United only touches upon the so-called dark money, the independent expenditures. So if the NRA or a Right to Life group wants to spend $1 million in a race, they can't say vote for X, but they can say, here's all the bad things about X, right? That's a classic independent expenditure. Now, those have to not be directly connected to the campaign committees. So they have to be operating, you know, separately. But what Citizens United said was, you can't put any limits on that money. So now we have unlimited dark money. We have super PACs, which have come about over the last 10 years as a result of that opinion. That actually has nothing to do, though, with limits on an individual or a corporation giving money directly to a candidate. Those limits have every single time at the U.S. Supreme Court been upheld, except for incredibly low limits. You know, $100 limit or something that was thrown out in Vermont a while back. But other than that, the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently upheld limits on political contributions. And so that's why we feel both federally under constitutional grounds and under our own state constitutional grounds, if you look around the country, we feel confident the Oregon Supreme Court should follow the will of the voters and follow the precedents that's already been set.
Well, we'll soon have that answer. If one were to set contribution limits, would there be a distinction between mega corporations such as Nike versus, for example, unions? Or should they be treated as one and the same for the purposes of contribution limits?
Well, this is where the devil's in the details. Where we are right now is the legislature last session looked at a bill. They had a proposed bill that would have put limits on individual contributions, PACs, corporate giving, all of those things. Mm-hmm. That did not pass. So we do not have a framework for that currently that the legislature has put forth. However, what the legislature did do is they sent a referral to the voters, SJR 18, which is going to be on everyone's ballot here in Oregon, November 2020. What that will do is amend the Oregon Constitution to say explicitly, our free speech clause does not prevent limiting political contributions, expenditures, and disclosing top donors. So the way I view this is, let's get SJR 18 passed or win at the Supreme Court. And then step two is figuring out what is our structure that will limit money in politics. Personally, and behalf of Honest Elections, you know, we'd like to see much lower limits, you know, for individuals and PACs. You know, I think somewhere around $500 for a legislative House race, maybe $1,000 for a Senate race, and something, you know, maybe a little higher than that for a statewide. Somewhere in that neighborhood, I feel pretty comfortable with as limits. Here in the city of Portland and the Multnomah County charter amendments that we passed, we put limits at $500 for city races, which I thought was pretty reasonable. So, you know, there's some negotiation and some wiggle room on that. Your other point is, should a corporation be treated the same way as a union? This is where things get really tricky. As part of our city of Portland and our county measures, what we created, which is really unique, they don't really exist around the country, was this concept of a small donor committee. And the idea was, if you have a lot of members and you can show that you're not just giving a lump sum $10,000, $20,000 out of your treasury, but that you're actually limiting those donations to an individual person who's being limited to X amount. So for example, in Portland and Multnomah County, we said $100 per person, but you can still give larger donations than the $500 limits. Thought being, if you're a union or a Right to Life group or, you know, some other OLCV, some other organization, if you have strength in numbers and you're limiting yourself, so it's sort of an input versus output, right? If the input is a limit of $100 per person or something like that, then, you know, we felt it was okay for you still to make larger contributions because it's still a pretty grassroots effort. It's only individuals giving and it's a limited per person number. So the unions really like that model, obviously, because they have a lot of members and it's somewhat easy for them to be able to transition to a small donor committee structure. So the bill that was before the legislature in 2019 did have a small donor committee element to that. The Republicans didn't like that because they thought that it was giving too much power to union interests. So that's still a sticky point. I can tell you that State Senator Jeff Golden is a true advocate, who's one of my favorite legislators down there in Salem on this issue. And he doesn't believe that any entity should be able to give unlimited donations. He thinks that everybody should have some cap, even if it's a larger cap, whether it's a state party, mm-hmm. Caucus committee, corporation, individual. So, you know, that's going to be one of the big fights moving forward is what do we do? What is the most fair structure to have a level playing field for people out
there?
Well,
and it sounds like a fight that was going to be set around party lines as well.
It's going to be set around party lines. But, you know, my attitude is if we can't get the right bill done at the legislature, the bill they had in 2019, frankly, just had way too many loopholes to allow big money. There were unlimited ways that people could give all the federal A federal candidate committee could still give unlimited. A state party could give unlimited. A caucus committee could give unlimited. But individuals were all capped. And I thought, well, you know, that's not necessarily fair because you're just entrenching the big party, the power of the big parties to be able to give larger donations and limiting individuals. So
yep.
I'd like to see a more even playing field structure for campaign contribution limits. And frankly, through our honest elections efforts, if we can't get something that we're happy with at the legislature in 2021, or even in this short session coming up, we're not afraid to go to the ballot and put a limits bill that we like to the voters directly in 2022.
Well, so, we'll also see what happens in 2020. But when we talk in terms of issues surrounding this, the details, the devil.
They always are in the details.
I think that's where I last saw him. When we imagine restraining the contributions at whatever level, Jason,
right?
There's a bunch of loopholes that those PACs and super PACs seem to manage to get around. Is there any way to avoid these loopholes, or should we even try?
Well, we should definitely try. A lot of people in my campaign finance reform don't like this analogy, but the way I view money in politics, it's like water running downhill. It's going to find ways because people that have a lot of money are going to rig the system to get their money to be able to have influence. So it's hard to come up with a perfect system that keeps all big money out of there, especially because we can't stop dark money right now. Because the Supreme Court decision at the U.S. constitutional level, we can't stop independent expenditures. So I think the best system is to try to limit all political donations to reasonable levels, have really good disclosures on who's giving the big money. So, for example, Oregonians for Good Puppies, right? That could be the name of an organization you could create.
Mm-hmm.
And you could give $1 million to say, don't vote for X, paid for by Oregonians for Good Puppies. Well, what if that's really Chevron, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to have a really good disclosure bill, you need some smart people to come together. And we put pretty good disclosure rules into our county and our city proposal. But you have to have a drill down measure, which gets to who are the true financial interests paying for these TV ads or these mailers. And that requires some burrowing, because sometimes you'll see a PAC mm-hmm. that'll give to a PAC that'll give to a PAC, and then that PAC will pay for the ad, right? So you got to have at least a 2 or 3 level drill down effort on disclosures. And beyond those two principles, disclosures and good limits, I really am a big fan of the idea of public funding. I would like to see candidates be able to get, you know, the Portland city, this cycle is starting up with a new matching contribution. If you raise, you know, I think $50 matches times 6, something like that. The Seattle model is one that I'm really intrigued with. I'm curious to see how it worked this last election, because Amazon tried to buy off the Seattle City Council. I don't know if you guys saw, but Amazon spent like $1.4 million to try to take out the left in the Seattle City Council, and they lost on most of those races. So I want to see how that public funding structure worked in that race. I want to look at some analysis. I haven't done that yet. But Seattle has an interesting model where every voter gets $100 in democracy vouchers, and you get 4 $25 vouchers in the mail, and you can give those vouchers to any of the candidates running for a city race or not. If you decide not to, the money just goes back into the kitty. I think that's kind of a neat model just in terms of grassroots organizing, because you could go around with an iPad going door to door. If people like your message, they could donate their democracy vouchers right there to your campaign. So, you know, the matching system I like. New York's had it for a long time, and it's been pretty effective. The Seattle model I like a lot. Public funding, though, does not poll as well because it's taxpayer dollars as limiting money in politics and putting disclosures out there. That's how, you know, we won with 89% of the vote on the Multnomah County Charter Amendment.
Understood. In a recent OPB article, Campaign Finance Limits on Track to Oregon Ballot, you were apparently quoted as saying that the Senate Republican walkout demonstrated some level of beholdenness to their big energy donors. In Oregon specifically, is there a partisan skew when it comes to receiving corporate donations?
Interesting question. I think that both of the parties, because there are no limits in money in politics, both of them have taken big money big money donations from corporations. I think the Republicans are more beholden to the big dollars, and I think this last legislative cycle was a perfect example of that. You had two Republican walkouts, one in regards to tax increases and one in regards to the cap and trade environmental initiative.
Yes.
Both those were hugely opposed by big corporate interests that give a lot of money to Republicans. And you didn't see the Republicans walking out of the legislature and refusing to participate in the system for moral issues. It wasn't, you know, gay rights or guns or abortion that traditionally have been, you know, Republican hot button issues. Mm-hmm. They were walking out to protect their donor class. And I think that that has moved the needle for the left and the Democratic Party. I think they watched that happen. And I think that's why we got the SJR 18 referral. I mean, we got this out of the building in 48 hours. And the Republicans came back Friday night. We passed SJR 18 out of the Senate Saturday, and we passed it out of the House on Sunday, right before the midnight, you know, ending. So it was a huge victory. As Dan Meek, who has been a longtime champion of campaign finance reform, said, this is the first good thing the Oregon legislature has done in regards to campaign finance reform since 1864 or something like that.
So, sounds like the only thing they've done.
The only thing they've done, yeah. Well, I think in 74 they did something on campaign finance reform, but they went backwards, as I recall. They did worse campaign finance reform. So,
given that Oregon is such an anomaly in terms of its lack of campaign finance regulation, Jason, are there any particular states or municipalities that currently set a model for campaign contribution restrictions, like Seattle, for example, that you mentioned? Has any of them, to your knowledge, gone far enough?
Well, you know, there are, I'm pretty sure Alaska and Montana have limits that are around $500. Now, those are pretty, you know, sparsely populated states. Both those limits, as I recall, have been upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals as constitutional. So a limit as low as 500, and don't quote me on the exact number, but I think they're both $500 limits. So, you know, what is fair? You know, you talk to politicians, they say, look, I want to pay my campaign staff a living wage. I get that. So I want to do, you know, a number which is fair, but which doesn't just lead to big money still being able to get big checks. So, mm-hmm. You know, there was a movement here in Oregon this last cycle that said, hey, let's go with the federal limits, which are now, I think, $2,800 a person.
Yes.
The problem I have with the federal limits for state races, for, you know, a legislative race, it's one thing if you're running for president or you're running for Senate, U.S. Senate. If you're running, you know, for a place that has 15,000 to 30,000 voters you need to win, $2,800, you times that by two for a spouse, then, you know, their kids donate, they get their friends over. Pretty soon you're putting together $20,000, $30,000 fundraisers quickly. So I think the federal number is a little high. That's why I'm sort of in that 500 to 1,000. I could probably be talked up a little higher than that if we could get something that everybody was on board with. But I think the bigger problem, so you have sort of two parts of this, right? What are the individual and the PAC limits you'd give? Mm-hmm. But then the other piece of it is, what do the state parties and the caucus committees and federal candidate committees, what do all of those entities get to do? So the example on the federal candidate committees, let's say I want to funnel a bunch of money into a race. With that last measure on limits at the 2019 legislature, I could create 100 federal campaign committees, say, you know, elect Jason Kefauri for, you know, tons of different races. I could put $1 million into each one of those, and I could have that entity give unlimited money to a state legislator. It'd be no problem under that last one. So we have to find the loopholes, and we have to have the good governance groups need to be at the forefront for drafting and creating that legislation. That's my personal belief.
And perhaps policing it as well.
Yeah. So and that gets into the whole redistricting effort too, but that's for another topic.
Fair enough. But looking ahead to the 2020 ballot measure that we're talking about, that measure calls for a constitutional amendment to allow districts to regulate contributions. What trends or attitudes have you observed in voters? Do independents, residents of swing counties, are you seeing support for the kind of contribution limits we're talking about?
Well, remember, what that SJR 18 will do in November 2020, it will amend the Constitution. There are a lot of knee-jerk reactions to amending the Oregon Constitution, so there's going to be a fair amount of voters that just say, I don't want to amend our Constitution no matter what. We have done some polling on limiting money in politics. I mean, the two best case examples, obviously, are the city of Portland and the Multnomah County, where we won with 89% of the vote and 87.5% of the vote. That's almost unheard of, to have a yes vote that high, even in a pretty liberal area. So what's interesting about limiting money in politics, though, it polls really well left and right. So, you know, there's data that shows, you know, 70-80% of Democrats support it, but also 60-65% of Republicans support it as well. So I think it's all going to come down to whether the big money tries to spend money to kill our constitutional amendment in November 2020. I think it's going to pass if we can get a broad coalition, and we're working to do that right now. You know, we have some of the Republican state legislators that voted for the SJR 18. We have them that are going to endorse the measure. So I would like to see a broad-based coalition that includes independents, Republicans, Democrats, third parties, civic groups across the different spectrum. I'd like to have everybody get on board to say, hey, let's come up with a fair system of what our electoral money and politics system should be.
Should the measure fail, should the legislature fail to take any meaningful action, is there anything that the courts could do?
Well, that's the thing. We have a dual track strategy here. Win at the ballot November 2020, and or win at the Supreme Court. The state of Oregon will get thrown into a bit of turmoil if the Supreme Court in 4 or 5 months just comes back and says, nope, we reversed the 97 decision, limits are okay now. I think that is going to lead to a really interesting political dilemma for the two parties, because the 2006 last attempt at the ballot for the voters, the limits on money in politics actually passed. Measure, I believe it was 47. However, the constitutional piece of it to amend the Constitution, that one failed. So right now we're in this flux position where would the 2006 limits come into play if the Supreme Court then says, why, yes, limits are okay. So, that will happen right in the middle of an election season. So that will be really interesting. I can tell you, the business interests, the Portland Business Alliance, the Realtors Association, you know, our opposition on the county measure before the Supreme Court, they asked the Supreme Court to delay the hearing at the Supreme Court so we could wait to see what the voters did in November 2020. The Supreme Court said no to that. So that to me is a signal that the Supreme Court may be ready. We have an entirely different makeup on the Oregon Supreme Court than we did in 97. So we're dealing with a whole new crop of people. And most of those, if not all of them, have been appointed by Democrats because the governor's been the Democrat, in the majority for the last 20 years. So I am cautiously optimistic that the Supreme Court is going to do the right thing. And I'd love to win both. I'd love to win the Supreme Court and actually win in November 2020 and amend the Constitution. That way we're ironclad moving forward.
And if we're headed in that direction, are there other legislative changes in addition to limiting campaign contributions that can be helpful?
In terms of money and politics influence?
Yes.
Well, we talked about the disclosures piece. I think that's critical, a really good drill down. We did pass a couple of disclosure pieces. I would like to see those strengthened in the coming legislative cycles. And, like we talked about earlier, I would like to see a public funding bill, a real public funding bill statewide. I think that would be fabulous. Let's watch and see how this plays out, the public funding for the city of Portland. Mayor Ted Wheeler just announced he's not going to use the public funding.
Yes.
And he announced he's going to decide how to limit his political contributions. So, you know, we sent him a letter to his campaign and to an email to his campaign person last week. We said, look, if you guys are going to take donations over $500, I want you to know that A, the Oregon Supreme Court may decide this and you're going to face the penalties, because there's penalties of between 2 to 20 times the infraction. Oof. Written into the charter amendment. So he's looking at a really large fine if the Oregon Supreme Court comes back. Regardless of what the Oregon Supreme Court does, we may go to court and ask a Multnomah County judge, because this gets into the weeds, but the Multnomah County judge ruled the limits unconstitutional, but there was never any effort to stop those limits from being in place. So our attitude is the limits are in place until the Supreme Court speaks. So that's a risk that that Mayor Ted Wheeler's campaign is going to have to take if they want to take large money donations.
Jason, it was interesting and even a little surprising to note that there's a significant amount of support among Republicans in the Oregon legislature for campaign reform. Considering the surprise factor, they should be invested in campaign contributions. What's the motivation for supporting campaign reform?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Why does limiting big money in politics poll well across the political spectrum? I think that there is an underlying populism to America that, you know, how did Donald Trump come out? I mean, there's right-wing populism and there's left-wing populism. You know, sort of Bernie Sanders and the Elizabeth Warren model on the left, and I hate to even discuss Donald Trump, but he did rev up a lot of, you know, working-class voters to get behind him. I think that there is, in general, disgust about big money in politics that goes across the political spectrum. I think no matter whether you're a working class Republican or a working class Democrat, you feel that the system is somewhat rigged and you feel that the average Joe doesn't have a voice in the system. So when you say, hey, I don't think people should be able to get unlimited money in politics, there is a certain inherent fairness that I just think humans have that resonates with people. Yeah, we should have a level playing field. Yeah, we shouldn't have some people have with big money be able to control everything. I just think that that's a pretty universal sentiment from humans across the political spectrum. So, and we can argue till the cows come home about what the limits should be and how it should work. But if you're just asking the question, should we not have billionaires and other people be able to buy elections, I think you're going to find 75-80% of people across the spectrum supporting that idea.
Really interesting. I just recently learned, Jason, that New York passed this IRV, election reform, about ranked voting. Could you tell me, is that something that Oregon's looking at? And would that have any impact on campaign finance reform?
Great question. So New York passed instant runoff voting. This is an idea that's been around for several decades. I believe Ireland uses it for all of their elections. San Francisco has used it for 7-8 years. I think maybe Australia too uses it. But the idea is you go into the ballot booth and we might like 2 or 3 candidates and we struggle to figure out who we like the most. So you go into the ballot booth and instead of just picking one, you do a ranked choice. So you say, here's my number one guy, here's my number two, here's my number three, here's my four. Then they count all the ballots. The last place person's votes then get tossed out, and all of his number one votes for number four go to the number one voter. And they go through this system. The idea being that in our two-party structure, third parties have a difficulty because they're always called quote-unquote spoilers, right? But in the ranked choice voting model, you can still vote for, you know, the Oregon Progressive Party, which I'm a part of, or the Constitutional Party on the right as your number one choice, and then you could still have a Republican or Democrat as your second or third choice. I guess the question is, does it lead to more candidates that I like being elected? I think we need to see it play out in more places. I know that Benton County down in Corvallis recently passed IRV, and I think that they have that as part of their election cycle coming up, and I think they just got the funding for it, in fact. So, you know, let's watch it play out in a place like Benton County. A lot of people say, oh, it's too confusing of a system. I think that's nonsense. We sit there and pick our sports teams all day long, and we say, he's my number one team, and this is my number two team, and number three. I don't see, you know, voters know how to rank things, and I would like to see it play out. But it is an interesting idea that may lead, as I like to say, to more voices and more choices being part of the electoral system.
Civic engagement is what this program is all about, and it's nice to support anything that can have a fair balance to that civic engagement. Jason, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. We'll keep you posted on the adventure we call campaign finance reform in Oregon.
Thank you for listening to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. Go to our website, insidewashco.org, to contact us or leave comments on this interview. This series is produced by Rick Paulson.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Next up, we have Wings at 9:30, the Women's International Network Gathering Services.
Now, Wings.
My belief is that power struggle is the basic addiction. We're using our communication skills as weapons, always trying to move the other person or convince them. And so what happens to us is, as soon as we feel any need to protect ourselves from another person, it can be as simple as someone in your household saying, "Do you always peel potatoes that way?" And right away, as we say, our back comes up and we want to defend, because we see protection and defensiveness as synonymous.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Sharon Ellison. Sharon Ellison comes from Eugene, Oregon, where I don't know if you've been living in Eugene for 30 years, but I know that you've been a therapist for 30 years. And now you're doing this work called Powerful Non-Defensive Communication, Sharon Ellison. So I'm sure that in 30 years you must have learned a lot about communication. Is that how you got into this work of non-defensive communication?
Yes, as I worked with my clients, I spent a great deal of time thinking about why people tend to want to close down in order to protect themselves, both in their intimate relationships and in their professional relationships, and also even in working in political movements. Mm-hmm. And as a result, I came up with an analysis of how we have built our entire communication process on a war model, so that when we communicate, we tend to want to protect ourselves in the same way we would in a physical war, mm-hmm. by withdrawing, defending, or counterattacking.
Well, I can see there's a lot of reasons to want to protect ourselves. This is a pretty dangerous world we live in.
Yes. I don't know why I'm laughing. Yes, it certainly is.
Because I don't know, I guess we're both laughing because it's like so apparent, and yet we're dealing with this. I mean, I say we because I concern myself a lot with the subject of communication and trying to get better at it and seeing how much of the problems in the world have to do with communication. And it seems very difficult to really get good at it. Some people have a gift, but I know that there are ways that one can learn, and that's what you're trying to teach, or you are teaching.
Yes. I think in response to what you're saying, I'd like to say two things. One is that one of the reasons that I believe we have such a difficult time learning to communicate effectively is because we have built a system of communication that's based on a war model or a power struggle model. So people have the experience of, no matter how hard I try to learn to communicate differently, it's the same old thing, it quote unquote, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the reasons that that happens is because we live with a myth, which is related to exactly what you were saying. We live in a world that is dangerous. And so when we communicate verbally using a power struggle or war model that's similar to the way we would protect ourselves in a physical war, we automatically assume that if we're going to protect ourselves, we have to defend ourselves. Even in many communication workshops where people are being taught to communicate cooperatively, and at least in the area that I live in, people talk a lot now about win-win communication, there's still an assumption that both people have to cooperate, or else my communication cannot be effective and very powerful. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we build our verbal communications on the idea that to be open is to be vulnerable, and to be vulnerable is to be weak, which is the same exact, in a sense, philosophy, or I would say even perhaps a myth, that we base our concepts of protection on when it comes to a physical war. Mm-hmm. And I personally believe that we can communicate openly and vulnerably and have 1,000 times the power that we would have when we communicate defensively.
Mm-hmm. We'll say more about that. How?
Well, first of all, the Oxford English Dictionary actually defines the word protection with the same exact words that it defines the word defensive. And if you like, I can read those words to you. They're extremely similar. To protect is to defend or guard from injury or danger. And to be defensive is having the quality of defending against attack or injury. And so what happens to us is, as soon as we feel any need to protect ourselves from another person, it can be as simple as someone in your household saying, "Do you always peel potatoes that way?" And right away, as we say, our back comes up and we want to defend, because we see protection and defensiveness as synonymous. And my belief is that in order to be secure, we need to be able to be more open, less anxious, and when we're constantly protecting ourselves in our verbal communications by becoming defensive, I think that we immediately cross an invisible line and become a victim. Because in order for me to be defensive, I have to perceive you as having more power than I do, at least potentially. Mm-hmm. In other words, I'm defending myself from your power. And we deal with power in our verbal communications the way we do in a war, where we assume that it's something external that we have to fight over. So either I have it or you have it. If you make a remark that somehow negates me or puts me down, then the way I conceive of protecting myself is to defend back, to either withdraw from you emotionally, to change the subject, to counterattack and say, "Well, what's the matter with the way I peel the potatoes?" But in some way, I'm seeing that I need to protect myself by defending myself, and so I automatically move into a victim stance. And I think most of us communicate from a place where we feel defensive and like victims almost all the time.
Like victims, you mean because we've been attacked, that's what you're saying, or that's how we see it.
That's right.
So what would you say in this example, why do you peel the potatoes that way? What would you do instead of being defensive?
Okay. May I say a couple of sentences to lay the groundwork for my answer here?
Sure.
First of all, when we're defensive, I think that we tend to misuse each of our three basic forms of communication, which are questions, position statements, and setting limits. And so when we're defensive, if we ask a question, we ask it in a way that often passes information instead of gathering it, like the person did when they said, "Do you always peel potatoes that way?" What they're really saying is, "That's a stupid way to peel potatoes." So it's not a genuine question. It's they're passing a judgment through the form of a question. Second, we tend to make position statements to convince other people of things. This happens frequently in political interchanges or, you know, in movements where people are trying to create some kind of effect, some kind of social change. And also, when we set a limit with a person, we tend to do it as a threat rather than to create security by predicting for the person how we're going to respond depending on what choice they make. So in the case of the simple example of do you always peel the potatoes that way, I might say, "What's the matter with it?" and say it in a defensive tone, which might be my way of defending back and saying, "Well, there's nothing the matter with it." Or I might try to convince the person and say, "Well, sure, I peel the potatoes this way. I always do. There's nothing wrong with it."
In fact, it's the best way.
Yes, as a matter of fact, yes. And that's the second thing we do with position statements, is we not only try to convince the other person, but we objectify. You know, we don't say, "I enjoy running. It's good for my health." We say, "Running is good for a person." You know, we make our subjective viewpoint objectified frequently. And so I might try to convince you and say, "This is a great way to peel potatoes. Look, you know, the reason I do it is this and blah, 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 and it is the best way." Or I might get angry and set a limit, but do it as a punitive thing to get you to leave me alone. I might just say, "Hey, you know, if you don't like it, just buzz off." What I believe is that in order to communicate non-defensively, I need to use a question to gather information I need to state my position as a descriptive and subjective statement of my own experience or how I see you or your behavior or your experience, and I need to set limits in a way that's neutral and clear so the other person has the same kind of predictability they would in the physical world to know how far the step is away from them when they step down so that they're not jarred. And in the case of the potatoes, I would ask the person, do you believe that I'm doing something wrong in the way that I'm peeling them? By starting with that kind of question, I draw out the other person's assumption, and then if they don't want to own it, they'll often drop it and leave it behind and treat me more respectfully. Or if they do want to own it, then they'll say, yes, I think that's a stupid way to peel the potatoes. And then I can state my own experience about why I do it that way, but I can do it in a non-defensive way. Now, it's hard for people to do, even in simple examples like that, because the tendency is to want, when asking the question, to have your voice come up, like, well, do you think I'm doing something wrong? And we even learn in school that a question comes up on the end and a statement comes down at the end. I think that a question sounds much more genuine and is much more likely to draw out good information from the person if it comes down at the end. So I would say, do you believe that I'm doing something wrong? And say it in a normal tone of voice. But when people get up in my workshops and start practicing how to ask questions, intelligent people will try one simple question 20 times and find that they're shaking their head, they're punctuating the words, they're coming up on the end, they're bugging their eyes, you know. The desire to express their defensiveness, if they try to get it out of their voice, tends to come out in their body. So it's not as easily said as done.
Do you think you have to seriously get over your defensiveness in order to not be expressing it some kind of way? I mean, I guess that depends on the speaker's real feelings and their beliefs.
I believe that I can express my feelings and my beliefs in a way that's very impassioned without being defensive. And I think that we create our reality in the same way we create a loaf of bread. If we put salt, water, and flour together, we get bread dough. If we put it in the oven and put hot air with it, then it rises and we get bread. If we mix salt, water, and dirt together, we get a mud pie. And my belief is that when we communicate defensively, we're creating a reality that creates insecurity and fear rather than a sense of internal peace and more confidence. And so the defensiveness itself, I think, is different than being able to really express the rest of my emotion. But if I do feel defensive, I teach people to learn to identify it and then talk about it in the moment, because that often dissipates it.
Mm-hmm. So that would be one way to get over it. So you're saying, it was very interesting what you said. You didn't exactly answer my question. Mm-hmm. If one has to really be feeling non-defensive in order to speak non-defensively.
No. Well, that's a very good question. The answer is no, I would say, because if I'm feeling defensive, I could still speak non-defensively about my defensiveness.
Okay.
I could say, when you said that, I felt really defensive and I felt like I wanted to defend myself. Mm-hmm. And so I can simply describe the process of defensiveness that I'm experiencing, and that would be, in fact, a non-defensive way to talk about my defensiveness.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like a lot of it is, with so many things, is some kind of being centered and calm oneself, which means, to use this common expression, not getting your buttons pushed, basically. And oftentimes these things happen so quickly.
I think that I can get my buttons pushed. I think every conversation is like a piece of clay that I can work with and rework. And so I advise people, if something comes out and it comes out in a rough-hewn way and you say something that doesn't come out the way you want, at least you're beginning to get it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not suggesting people go around justifying speaking to each other abusively, but you can go back and say, you know, when I talked to you, there was something I didn't say, or I said this in a way that I didn't feel okay about. Can we please talk about it again? And then I go back and I rework it. And I think that that's what makes it an ongoing process of really working with and evolving how I communicate. I believe how we communicate is who we will become.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to remind my audience here, that my guest is Sharon Ellison, who teaches non-defensive communication in Eugene, Oregon, and she's down here in the Bay Area, where in Berkeley right now, where we're talking.
I remember you talking before when I met you about something more about the war model. I wish you would just expand on that a little bit, about the kinds of words that people use, this kind of thinking that comes out of the war model. You alluded to it in the beginning, but I'd just like you to say more about it and give some examples, if you would, to bring people's attention so that, at the very least, people who hear this program can start noticing mm-hmm. the kinds of words that all of us so often use. I think that when we communicate from a war model, we are often defensive in one of three primary ways. We use words that surrender our position, we withdraw, or we counterattack. When we surrender, we can surrender in a way that we're a traitor to ourselves. So if somebody says, "You haven't written for so long, I thought you didn't care about me anymore," I might say, "Oh, I'm sorry." And that person is suggesting to me that I don't care about them, and I'm apologizing for not caring, even though I probably do care about that person. And so I surrender my own position to the other person. And to say I'm sorry right away to someone when we don't feel that we've done something that was hurtful is really a surrendering of our own position. Then we often do another way of surrendering, which I call surrender sabotage, where I might say to you, "Oh, I'm really sorry that your feelings were, you know, that I hurt your feelings by not writing to you, but I've been really busy." So first I say I'm sorry, and then I justify my behavior and try to convince you to let me off the hook. Another way to do that can be much more pointed. I might say to you, "I'm so sorry. Are you always so sensitive?" In this mm-hmm. sweet little voice that's stabbing to the other person. I might take on extra work at work and not complain to the person that gives it to me and tell everybody else, "I can't understand why that person gave me this extra job right now when this is the busiest time of year." Often when we sabotage, we undermine ourselves, so we may not get a project done on time or procrastinate even though we've said we would do it. When we withdraw, we often change the subject on someone. So somebody may, in response to someone who made the comment about the potatoes or about the letter, I might just say, "Oh, well, would you like a glass of water?" Or, "Let's sit down and talk now." But I'm not really responding to what the person is saying. Another way to withdraw is to say, "Oh, I really hear what you're saying. I hear that you're feeling hurt. I'm sorry that you felt hurt by my not writing," which suggests that somehow it's really the other person's problem, but we withdraw from it. We may counterattack in one of two ways. We may defend ourselves by saying, "I'm just not a letter writer, you know, I just don't write letters." And or we may attack the person and say, "How can you say that I don't care about you when I've been there for you all these years?" So we can counterattack either by defending our own position or by attacking the other person's position. And as soon as we do that, what I think we do, as I mentioned earlier, is we then misuse how we ask questions, how we state our position, and how we set limits. And we use each of those forms of communication as weapons instead of tools. We might as well be trying to build a house by pounding nails with a saw or sawing boards with a hammer. If I am asking a question and passing information to you by being sarcastic through my question or leading, then it's just the opposite of what a question is designed to do, which is to gather information. So people could look and watch and listen to themselves ask questions and see how often they're asking a question that isn't really a question, mm-hmm. or how often they're stating a position in a way that's convincing. A teacher might say to a student, who says, "I can't do my math." "Yes, you can. You can do it." Now what I'm doing is I'm making an objective statement and I'm trying to convince that student. So that's another way that we misuse these skills. And when we set limits, we often do it as a threat to get the person to make the choice we want them to make. So you might hear yourself saying to your child or to your partner, "If you don't take care of this, you're really going to have a problem," or "This is going to happen," or "That's going to happen." But we use it as a way to pressure someone. So what we're really doing here is we're both defending ourselves in a warlike way, and we're using our communication skills as weapons, always trying to move the other person or convince them. And so what happens is we're in a power struggle. And as soon as we're in that power struggle, the only goal is to win, and we might as well quit communicating.
Yeah, well, that's this power struggle business. I really notice that happens so much. And I'm getting to the point where I know that I don't know. I just feel tongue-tied because I start noticing the dynamic, but it seems to me that, at least in my experience, it takes a long time to learn these other kinds of communication skills. Do you think that that's true? It takes a long time. Is that so in your experience? People who've taken my workshops come back saying two things. One, they say it's revolutionary and disarming, that it seems to be very quickly effective, so that they are able to, in a fairly short order, begin to practice these skills. And that's one reaction, which I think suggests there can be some pretty rapid change. And if you like, in a minute, I'll give a couple examples of that. The other reaction is that it feels overwhelming because it's like a whole other way of being, that we are so used to responding defensively. And my belief is that power struggle is the basic addiction, so that when we're in power struggle, even if we win this round, we might lose the next round. And I think the levels of increasing anger we see in our culture really relate to the progressive disability that comes from power struggle as an addiction.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean as an addiction? I mean, why do you use that word? I mean, there's a lot of power struggling going on. I quite agree, but why do you say addiction?
Well, if you grab my hand and I grab your hand and we pull on each other, where is our energy going?
We're doing it as you can't see us, but I don't know. I can't concentrate and do that. But it feels like it's in where our hands are meeting.
Yes, it's in the friction. And my belief is that we pour about 95% of all our communication energy on Earth into a power struggle hole, like those dense holes in the universe that the scientists talk about that absorb energy and never let it escape. And so when I say it's an addiction, it's because once you're in power struggle, it's like a craving. The only thing you want is to win. And you always feel powerless, because even if you win this round, you know you may lose the next round. And so there's an addictive quality to it, that you've got to always be on guard, you've got to always be looking out. You begin to see other people as intentionally wanting to hurt you instead of just reacting from their own issues and their own problems. And so the intensity of the power struggle, like a competition, becomes heavier and heavier and heavier, and there's no end to it, and there really is never any winner, because all the energy simply goes into the struggle. If we could free up our energy by communicating non-defensively, I think the level of creative energy that we would possess would be phenomenal.
Yeah, well, that sounds right. And I see why you say addiction, too. I'm thinking about it. Also, addictions get worse as time goes on.
Yes.
And there's something to this. I'm speaking from my own experience, but I know it's not only me. There's something that makes you feel alive about the fight.
Yes.
Kind of that's exciting. It's also very, as you say, wearing and tiring and
yes.
wasteful and doesn't get anywhere. And also just this old habit of that's how we've been doing it for so long. In politics, I mean, I have all this rhetoric that says this is not the way. I mean, it says a lot of the things you've just been saying. But so often I don't know how else to do it, and nonviolence doesn't necessarily seem to get anywhere either. I mean, getting arrested or something. How do you work in the short time we have left? If you could share something. I know you've worked with some political organizations about how you work with this in non-defensive communication, Sharon Ellison, in a political context, a social activism context.
We assume that we're going to have more impact and more power if we're out there fighting fire with fire. And I don't believe it's true. I think what happens is we simply take our communications to the lowest common denominator. One woman who has been very active in politics in the Bay Area took my workshop and went to a weekend political retreat and training session and said she tried the non-defensive communication, where she would have argued with four or five people she was talking to who she heartily disagreed with in the past. She asked them very thorough questions and then stated her own position from her own heart, rather than stating her position to convince them or try to move them. And what she discovered was that three of the five people in that group came up to her later and said, you know, what you said was so powerful, I felt like I need to really reconsider my position. So it's my belief that in political movements, we can still ask very, very thorough questions, even in group discussions. We can state our position from our heart, and it's going to be more powerful if we're not defensive. Most of the time when we say our position in that political arena, we're countering someone else, mm-hmm. instead of coming from our own full creative power of our own vision of
the subject. And in many cases, both in politics and other difficult situations, for example, sexual harassment, I've found people able to change realities with one single question. I've had several women who were being sexually harassed who, in various ways, asked the harasser, "Did you believe I wanted you to touch me that way? What made you believe you had the right to ask me to kiss you?" And in every single case that I know of, the harasser, when asked directly in a straightforward, non-defensive way, said, "I didn't have a right. I think you didn't want me to touch you that way, and I'll never do it again." And I think that same kind of power can carry over to the political arena. What I find is that if I ask people non-defensive questions, very often they take a huge quantum leap in how they respond to me. I mean, I was buying tires one day, and a man said to me, who was selling them, "You don't need to know this. You don't need to know that." And I got very angry, of course, and, you know, my feminist buttons were all pushed, and I was thinking of him as a blinkety-blank male chauvinist pig. But I went back and asked him a sincere question, which was, "Do you believe I don't need to know about the tires I'm buying?" And he stopped dead cold and took what I now call the quantum leap in non-defensive communication and said, "Oh, no, it's just that I used to teach at this particular place, and the students never listened to me or respected what I said." And that man followed me out to the sidewalk, shaking my hand, and I think probably felt heard for the first time in years and respected, because while I was thinking he was negating me, he was defending himself, thinking that I didn't respect his knowledge about the tires. And we see this kind of, I see this kind of transforming response again and again and again when I and other people use non-defensive communication. A friend of mine, a therapist, said that she believes that non-defensive communication is the next evolutionary step. That if we continue to communicate in a warlike mode, we will destroy ourselves, and that political change, as personal change, will come from starting truly with ourselves and focusing on how we communicate in a peaceful and non-defensive fashion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And when that happens, it's also quite contagious. I think that it would take fewer people than we think to reach critical mass in any given situation and stimulate a change in how groups of people are communicating.
Uh-huh. Well, there I was interrupting you, just interrupting you to say how people didn't listen, because that was my point that I was going to make, that I'm really glad you got around to, because I know personally, and I've noticed, that people don't much listen. So when you're asking questions, or they don't listen as much as I would like, and probably as much as a lot of people would like. And so the asking questions, you're putting your attention on the other person. You're actually showing some interest in them, which is probably, in my mind, part of what's going on, is that they're then more likely to calm down and listen to you.
It also, yes, and it requires them to take responsibility for clarifying and owning what they're saying, so that I'm not in the position of defending myself and someone else is denying that they're really doing anything negative to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I want to thank you very much, Sharon Ellison. My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.
Sharon Ellison's website includes a set of exercises to identify your own defensive reactions and replace them with powerful non-defensive communication. Visit www.pndc.com. Wings is a weekly half-hour program which has been in distribution since 1986. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. And follow our daily news feed on Facebook, facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, especially your local community radio stations. Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose many books include the pamphlet length 36 Steps Toward a Gift Economy, available online. Opening music was from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. We now close the program with an excerpt from Joyce and Jackie's album Higher Ground.
Say we want peace.
Say we want peace.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9:58 a.m. Stay tuned at 10 a.m. for Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, followed at 11 by The Dirtbag Show. Don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. If you want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming, then download our mobile app today.
The Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center wouldn't exist without the local folks who volunteer their time to help the homeless.
In episode 4 of the third season of Local Folks Podcast, we meet Tiana, Pete, and John to learn what they do, why they volunteer, and what they have learned about the homeless and themselves as a result. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folks.
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Flashpoints. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the show, we rebroadcast Flashpoints interviews from the last two programs on the spiraling crisis with Iran. All this coming up next. Stay tuned.
I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, we are delighted to be joined again by John Pilger, award-winning filmmaker. There's many things to talk about. There are a couple of news items that we need to get to. John Pilger, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis. Very good to be back on the program.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Let's start with the assassination. Obviously, this has sort of turned the world upside down. It's unbelievable. You got the U.S. Secretary of State saying that the killing of this leading Iranian official, revered, bringing tears to many people in the streets of Iran now. This has made life safer for Americans. That's the response.
Well, we have been here before through recent years and even before that, of course, but this is especially alarming and in its extreme provocation. And what's different, I think, is that there's no real attempt to justify it at all with evidence.